From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network.
Dr. Marnie Falk is an associate professor of pediatrics at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She focuses her research on the genetics of mitochondrial respiratory chain disease. Dr. Falk, how common are mitochondrial diseases and what causes most of these disorders?
Mitochondrial diseases are much more common than I think anybody had really anticipated until really very recently. According to our best estimates, now a minimum of 1 in 5,000 people at some point across their lifetime are affected with mitochondrial disease. There's even been some studies that mutations in mitochondrial DNA that are disease-causing potentially occur in every 1 in 200 births. So really, it affects many more people than we had thought. And what they are really disorders involving dysfunction of the mitochondria, most commonly thought of as energy deficiency, but also involving a host of other problems caused when the mitochondria aren't doing their job. So the mitochondria should be doing many different things, including initiating cell death when necessary, regulating the calcium levels within the cell, controlling the metabolism of many basic chemicals within the cell, intermediary metabolism, and many other functions. And so when the mitochondria aren't doing its job, almost any body part can be affected. We typically think of the diseases as affecting high-energy tissues, so the brain, the heart, the skeletal muscle, the GI system. And there's a whole range of problems that people could develop depending on how much residual mitochondrial function they have. In terms of what causes them, I think we're now becoming more and more aware that there's a genetic cause for many of the different mitochondrial diseases, but that genetic cause could either be a defect within the mitochondrial DNA or mutations with any of a number of nuclear genes. We already know of more than 60 different nuclear genes that can cause mitochondrial disease, but there's probably upwards of several hundred, if not 1,000 different genes that could be implicated in mitochondrial dysfunction in some way. And the reason we know that is because depending on the different tissue, mitochondria themselves have between 800 and around 1,500 different proteins. And most of those proteins, the grand majority, come from different nuclear genes. And then, of course, environmental factors, you know, pesticides and toxins and different chemicals, heavy metals are all known to cause mitochondrial dysfunction. For some drugs, it's actually their intended effect. And for other environmental agents, of course, it's the unintended effect for it to hurt human mitochondria. And then finally, it's becoming more and more understood that complex diseases, things like Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease, diabetes, often come from an accumulation of mitochondrial DNA defects over one's lifetime that variably affect different tissues. So I think my answer is, ultimately, again, they really are disorders of energy metabolism and all of that, all that means, affecting every different tissue. And I think for the most part, there's a genetic cause in terms of whether it's a single genetic cause or an accumulation of genetic causes contributes to the variation.
How much is actually known about the inner workings of mitochondria?
It's been known for, you know, more than 50 years, and the Nobel Prize was awarded for figuring out that their respiratory chain functions within the mitochondria to take the basic components of the food we eat, combine it with oxygen, and produce energy. So that very elegant system is one of the main functions of the mitochondria. For a long time, it was thought that it was all figured out. And then I think over the last 15 to 20 years, there's sort of been a resurgence of interest in realizing how little we understand about all of the other things going on in the mitochondria. So there really has been an explosion, I'd say, at least over the last 5 to 10 years, of understanding of just how complex and integral normal mitochondrial function is. So the mitochondria are dynamic. They're moving. They are using the cell cytoskeleton to actually move. They're combining with one another. They're fizzing and they're fusing to repair each other. They're replicating themselves. They have much of their own machinery to do this, but They also require the import of many different nuclear genes to allow this to occur. In terms of the metabolism and the apoptosis functions and, this, and the calcium homeostasis, I think all of this is becoming increasingly understood. So there's really the complexity of how much is really going on. You know, the textbook model that's the powerhouse of the cell is a good starting place, but it's really an enormous oversimplification. But I think people are making really excellent strides to just now begin to understand the workings of the whole mitochondria, and in particular, people are still focusing on the respiratory chain, that last part of the many pathways that make energy, because when that doesn't work, there's really the most severe consequences. And it's also the types of mitochondrial disease that we're able to diagnose based upon biochemical studies in patients. And it's also right now thought to be some of the most common causes of mitochondrial disease.
What was the purpose of the experiment that you and your team conducted?
The purpose of our experiment was to better understand the first complex of the five-complex respiratory chain. So the respiratory chain in humans is largely understood, and yet many of the components that contribute to that system are poorly understood. Complex 1 is really an enzyme that's made up of 45 different subunits in mammalian mitochondria. And bacteria, which are really what mitochondria are, when bacteria essentially invaded other cells to permit multicellular life to evolve 2 billion years ago, complex 1 only has 14 subunits, and yet human complex 1 has evolved to have 45 subunits. And so the reason for why so many more subunits are needed and what they're doing is unclear. And so the purpose of our experiment is to say, okay, if bacteria have complex 1 and we have complex 1 and it's evolved over time, can we use an intermediary model animal to understand what are the functions of the different subunits? And so the way that we chose to do this was to knock down all of the conserved subunits that make up all the different genes that encode different subunits in complex 1 and say, well, what's the function? Are all of these critical to producing energy? Are all of these critical to the animal? If we inhibit or reduce the levels of any of these, will we see dysfunction either within the mitochondria or within the animal? Can we better understand what the roles of these specific subunits in these genes are so that we could understand, one, to predict which genes might even be causative of human complex 1 dysfunction, and two, are there specific functions that we could learn of that we might be able to treat over time?
Can you tell us a little bit more about your use of knockdown gene technology and RNAi, which is a very, very intense area of study in the life science industry. And what were your results?
Absolutely. So RNA interference was really discovered only about a decade ago by Andy Fire and Craig Mello, who won the Nobel Prize for it, in C. elegans. And so what RNA interference is really just an evolved physiologic process essentially to defend the cell against invading viruses or RNA, such that when the cell sees these double-stranded RNA molecules from an invading virus, it responds by cutting up or dicing up that RNA, that double-stranded RNA molecule, to shut off the gene that was producing it. And so it's a way of shutting off the genome of the invading organism. But what's remarkable in C. elegans, and this was discovered in C. elegans, and of course, as you just mentioned, it's being aggressively studied, you know, in every organism and has revolutionized the way we do our science as well, is that in worms, when you feed them double-stranded RNA, so you don't even need to inject them, the response of the organism is to shut off the corresponding gene, and it actually shuts off its own gene as well. And it not just shuts off the gene in one cell, but it shuts off the gene in all the cells. And so as long as you feed the animals the specific bacterial strain that produces the double-stranded RNA of the target gene of interest that you want to shut off, you will shut off that gene, or at least knock it down so that that gene is producing lower levels of the corresponding RNA. And you do that in every cell of the animal for as long as the animal is being fed that double-stranded RNA. It's remarkable.
And regarding the work about how mitochondrial gene defects impair respiration after you did these studies, what actual results did you get?
So of the 45 subunits that I alluded to in the human complex one, we first did some in silico modeling to even figure out how many are there in worm complex one, since it wasn't known. And so according to our work, all of the mitochondrial DNA-encoded subunits, there are seven of those, are all conserved in C. elegans to variable degrees at the protein level. But of the 38 nuclear-encoded subunits, only 31 we predict to exist in the worm. And of those 31, we knocked down 28 of the different genes. And what we found was that, you know, much as we anticipated, not all of the complex one subunits equally impact respiratory function, so that you could actually knock down several of these complex one subunits and there is no impairment in respiratory chain function, or taken to mean their ability to produce energy, so that these complex one subunits must be having other perhaps moonlighting roles besides simply critical to producing energy. And what we, the types of analysis we did, is we realized it's known from other model animals, mainly bovine taurus mitochondria, where you could study enormous amounts of mitochondria from essentially the muscle from cows. It's been determined over the last decade that there are three major subcomplexes of the very large complex one. Again, complex one's like a one kilodalton complex. And when you grind it up, the subunits come off in different groupings according to their location in the mitochondria. So that the beta subunits are those that are actually bound tightly within the mitochondrial membrane itself, whereas the one lambda subunits are those that protrude into the mitochondrial matrix, the inside of the mitochondria. And we found that it's those subunits in the subcomplex 1 lambda that protrudes into the matrix that really appear to be controlling the respiratory function of complex 1. And that's not really a huge surprise. It's sort of like the saying in real estate that location is everything. When you produce substrates to feed into the mitochondria through the matrix side. So this subcomplex is really where the basic components of the sugar that you eat and the protein that you eat get converted into NADH to flow through complex one. And so it's these subunits, when you decrease their levels, that you're not forming complex one correctly and complex one isn't working correctly. And then we've also gone on to show, and a big part of this the functions that were studied in this paper, that complex, how it's functioning, actually determines how the whole animal is responding to anesthesia. And the reason we got into this is because it's really not known how volatile anesthetics work. We know that they do. We know that when you need surgery and somebody gives you an inhaled anesthetic, that you go to sleep, and that you wake up when they turn it down and there's a key dose needed. But nobody knows quite what the target is of how that's happening. And so that's been an intense area of research for many decades. And so my collaborators, with whom I wrote this paper, Drs. Morgan and Sedensky, who are now at the University of Seattle, are anesthesiologists who in the 1990s did a mutagenesis screen in C. elegans to figure out, is there an animal that responds differently to volatile anesthetics? Almost every animal can be anesthetized, and there's usually a very narrow range where that occurs. So in their mutagenesis screen, they found that one animal really was significantly more sensitive to the anesthetic. So at a third of the dose, it was equally anesthetized, which in worms has an assay similar to measure paralysis, essentially, or reversible paralysis. And when they cloned the gene in the 1990s, they learned that gene was actually encoded a subunit of complex 1. And that's really where all of this began, when we realized that when you inhibit a specific component of the respiratory chain, you're changing the whole animal behavior. And so one of the things we did in this paper was to go through systematically and say, of all of the different complex 1 subunits, do they all do that? Do they all cause the animal to be sensitive to anesthesia? And the answer is no, they don't. Some really do. They cause significant hypersensitivity, and here we use the volatile anesthetic halothane. But some of them don't at all, and actually a few actually cause anesthetic resistance. So what we've shown is that it's the subcomplex 1 lambda, again, the one protruding into the matrix arm, that the degree to which you knock down those subunits and the degree to which you're impairing complex 1's ability to participate in mitochondrial respiration, you've actually determined the effects at the whole animal level to volatile anesthetics. And this has a clear translational relevance, because Drs. Morgan and Sadensky also anesthetize human beings when they go for surgeries, and they have done some studies to show that it's really individuals where complex one respiration is dysfunctional that you have to be concerned that they too will be sensitive to anesthetics, which means that you really need to carefully monitor them, because at a fraction of the dose, which would cause a normal person to be anesthetized, they will already be anesthetized. And so you don't want to have any over anesthesia if you weren't aware of this. You wouldn't want to over anesthetize somebody with too high a dose. And so it's really shown that these findings are really holding true, you know, across species, but now we're starting to understand which complex is causing this, complex one and not another complex, and which parts of complex one are causing this.
Yeah. Now, picking up on this translational theme, in addition to sensitivity to anesthesia, and again, looking down the road, how might this research eventually lead to new therapeutics for human diseases caused by mitochondrial dysfunction?
Absolutely. That's, of course, our role as well. One of my hats is I run the mitochondrial genetics clinic here at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and that's clearly our priority, is how do we improve the lives of people. Up until now, really, until the last 3 or 4 years, we've had a very hard time even understanding what causes an individual person's mitochondrial dysfunction, meaning when you, in the best of hands, when you suspect mitochondrial disease, you can only really figure out a biochemical problem such as complex one dysfunction maybe in 10% of the time. According to some laboratories, in the best of hands, you really don't understand the clear cause of mitochondrial dysfunction in a given person in as many as 60% of patients that come through specialty clinics. Really, the big advance in the last few years has been that there's been really an explosion in our ability to diagnose the biochemical changes that we're seeing in mitochondrial, in suspected mitochondrial disease, as well as increasingly the genetic causes. And so while we very much want to develop novel therapeutics and effective therapeutics, we really have to understand really the basic mechanism of what's causing the disease, so that there's really not one genetic cause for all of these people's mitochondrial dysfunction. Like I said, there's hundreds, if not 1,000 different causes across 2 different genomes. And so the work that we're doing is trying to understand what are the consequences of specific genetic dysfunction, meaning in specific genes, on the cell, on the animal, on the mitochondria. And so one of the ways in which my laboratory is moving forward now from this work is that we're using all of the different investigative advantages, I guess you could say, of the C. elegans model to understand whole animal effects of respiratory chain dysfunction, you know, of individual genetic causes of respiratory chain dysfunction, of isolated mitochondrial effects of these different genetic causes of mitochondrial disease, and really to start exposing these different genetic model animals to different therapies. And so we've already had some preliminary evidence to suggest that while we may not be able at this stage to give back a normal gene product or to change the effects of the genetic mutation, we know that there's enormous consequences when the respiratory chain doesn't work on many different physiologic aspects that we can intervene with. So that why are there so many different diseases and why are they so variable? I suspect that some of it is due to a lack of ATP, but that also some of it's due to the rest of your metabolism backing up, if you will, or having blocks. And so can we go in and relieve those blocks and alleviate some of the cellular contribution to the dysfunction? Metabolic modifiers is really what our lab is looking into. And we've had some exciting preliminary evidence that yes, we can do this, that we can take the genetic models, study the effects on the mitochondria and on the whole animal, and do it in a way that we're doing it in living animals. So in human beings, you can't do that. There's so many different genetic causes, and there's so few individuals with each specific type of genetic cause that it's really hard to get the numbers that you need to do clinical studies to really determine what are effective therapies and what are the common consequences of disease. But in a genetic model like C. elegans, in a matter of weeks, you could have millions of genetically identical animals, and you control the environmental milieu, and you can simply change, one component, such as the drug that they're feeding on, and you can see how that changes everything else downstream in a living animal. And so that's what's so powerful about the C. elegans model, and of course the fact that RNA interference works so beautifully in C. elegans to knock down each of these genes is really an advantage, because the respiratory chain is so critical that for many of these genetic components, if you completely knock them out, you wouldn't have a viable animal to study. And so that's why, you know, using RNA interference to knock down specific genetic components and seeing what are the consequences and studying, you know, the effects on, you know, I told you respiration and anesthesia, but we also look at in vivo free radical stress, and we look at in vivo membrane potential, and we look at in vivo metabolism. And so really understanding what are the consequences of specific causes and what are the effects in specific causes of different treatments is really powerful. And then we're hoping to bring that back then to the patients with actually some, you know, more rational, I guess, evidence for which therapies to try, rather than just going to the health food store and telling them, you know, good luck.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. If you would like to comment on this week's podcast, please go to our podcast section at www.genengnews.com and give us your thoughts. We'd really like to hear from you. Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghaus, saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.